Hey everybody, welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer and professor.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer and editor.
How you doing, Naomi?
I'm doing well, thank you, Aaron. Last time we talked about how one of my fingers was partly severed, and now it's all but reattached, which is quite amazing, the human body's ability to grow parts. Or zip parts together.
Sounds like a David Cronenberg.
So David quite impressed by that.
Sounds like a David Cronenberg movie at this point.
Yes, yeah. It is a little bit on the horrific side.
Future topic of Sweat.
And I'm getting close to finishing the novel that I'm writing, so I'm very happy.
Well, that's good. Well, that's a big point of our visit here to Montreal. It's like a creative retreat.
Yes.
It's been very productive for you, right?
Yeah, and how about you, Aaron?
I'm good, yeah. Just lots of podcasting projects, writing projects. It's been exciting. It's been exciting to see Sweater Weather sort of take root and for us to make plans for the next season, all that. That's been happening the last month or two. So yeah, it's been pretty good. Although I am missing home.
Yeah. Home is nice.
Yeah. I miss our stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're each living out of one suitcase, which gets a little old eventually.
Naomi, we've been talking about plans for the podcast. We have plans for a long, productive run with the show.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting.
Now, if you like Sweater Weather, we'd really appreciate your support, which you can do in several different ways. If you find us on Spotify or Apple Podcast, if that's where you listen to us, is audio. A review would be really nice. If you see us on social media anywhere, just a like or a share would be really helpful. And of course, you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/Canadian Sweater. If you really like the show and you want to support us with a monthly donation, that could really help with some of the expenses, ongoing expenses of the show. What do you have to say about that, Naomi?
Yes, we could really use some help. Thank you very much. And I know there's people out there who love the show because they tell me that they do.
The numbers are good. Numbers are good. Our numbers are going up every episode. So we really appreciate the audience out there and your support.
Yeah, and if you don't want to give us a monthly donation, that's okay too. Thank you for listening.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Our topic today, it's the film The Sweet Hereafter. 1997 film written and directed by Adam Egoyan, based on the 1991 novel of the same name by American author Russell Banks. Now, there's a warning about today's topic. The film deals with accidental death of children as well as sexual abuse. So the film is not graphic or explicit in any way, nor will we be in our discussion, but just wanted to warn you about that. The Sweet Hereafter is set in the fictional small town named Sam Dent. It's in the interior of British Columbia, where a school bus accident kills many of the town's children. Now, this brings to Sam Dent a lawyer from the big city who tries to convince the surviving parents to initiate a class action lawsuit. The film stars Ian Holm as the lawyer, Mitchell Stevens, and Sarah Polley as Nicole Burnell, a girl who survives the bus crash. Now, joining us today to talk about The Sweet Hereafter is Abdul Malik. So Abdul is a Pakistani-Canadian screenwriter. He spent almost a decade in Canada's labor and environmental movements before co-writing the feature film Peace by Chocolate, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. He's recently written for series such as CTV's Transplant and has a new feature in post-production. His articles on the intersections of politics and sports have appeared in publications such as Jacobin and Canadian Dimension. Abdul, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Really happy to be here. It's been a while since I've been on a podcast, and I love talking movies.
Now, is this a movie, or is Adam Egoyan a filmmaker that you knew or knew well or had opinions about before, rewatching or watching this film for today?
I mean, here's the part where I question, like, will I ever meet Adam Egoyan and will he ever hurt me?
You know what? I would assume that maybe he would see this at some point. I don't know.
I mean,
I have no idea. Like,
To put it kindly, like I would say that I think there's a lot of good to most Adam McGoyan movies, and I think Adam McGoyan is I think he's an interesting filmmaker. I think even films like this are very like it's interesting to take a retrospective at something that's considered such a gem of Canadian cinema, right? And stuff like that, but I don't think his neither his filmmaking style nor his thematic sensibility has really progressed beyond stuff like Ararat or The Sweet Hereafter, right? Especially thinking of his like contemporaries, like what David Cronenberg's done in the intervening period, and like other filmmakers, the Toronto New Wave, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, he's someone we haven't heard a lot of, at least I haven't. I mean, I'm not super duper plugged into every new release in Canadian cinema, but I actually since The Sweet Hereafter and then Ararat, which was in 2002, I don't recall really noticing another Adam McGoyan film. And that's very different than a David Cronenberg for sure.
It's also just very interesting because like that his era of filmmakers, like the most successful one is probably at this point like Jeremy Podeswa, right? Who is at this point just a TV guy. And he's a extremely gifted filmmaker and amazing director. But like yeah, a lot of, and a lot of these guys just made near perfect movies, like Don McKellar's like Last Night,
Yeah, love
absolutely
it. Future
terrific.
topic of sweater weather.
Yeah, but that's bring me back for that. That's maybe my favorite Canadian movie.
Oh, good, good, good.
I love when I saw that movie, I just loved it. Many years ago now,
And
but
like even people like I think of John Grayson, who was like my professor in film school. He's a good friend of mine, right? And he's now moved like firmly into the realm of like experimental cinema with like weird home video cameras and stuff like that. Like he's so uninterested in narrative, but Adam McGoyan soldiers on for better or like regrettably for mostly worse, right?
Got it. Got it. Yeah, I mean, I have to say my opinion of Adam McGoyan as a filmmaker is almost solely is actually is solely this film and maybe a little bit Exotica, a film from a couple of years before The Sweet Hereafter. I think those are the only two Adam McGoyan films that I've actually seen or that I recall
Okay.
seeing.
Same here, except I've also seen Ararat. And I saw an opera that he wrote.
That's right. Incredibly artsy guy. He's really into opera and he's directed several of them at the Canadian Opera Company, something I'm going to mention here in the background. So, should I just jump into a little bit of background about Adam McGoyan?
Go for it.
So Adam McGoyan was born in Cairo, Egypt, in 1960 to Armenian Egyptian parents, Shushtan and Joseph. They were artists and operated a furniture store. So his first name, Adam, is spelled ATOM, is in honor of Egypt's first nuclear reactor. Do you know that?
No,
I had
that's
no.
amazing.
I just thought I assumed it was an Armenian spelling of the name, but no.
I
In fact, it's a pun on atomic. So President Nassar of Egypt at the time, I guess he acquired this nuclear reactor from the Soviet Union in 1958. A monumental political moment, especially for his parents, I guess. So the parents and the family moved to Victoria, British Columbia in 1962 when Adam was two. He has one sister named Eve. She is a concert pianist in Toronto. Now, when he was young, Adam read the plays of Harold Pinter and Samuel Beckett, and he admired the films of Ingmar Bergman, especially the
As
film.
teenagers do, right? As
Yeah,
teenagers definitely do.
of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I always felt like this sort of stuff is you putting a retrospective shine on your upbringing. You know what I mean? Like I don't believe a 14-year-old reads Pinter and is like, I am going to
He was a genius prodigy, okay.
He does seem very self-conscious. He seems self-consciously artsy in his filmmaking, from what I've seen of it, and yes, and the kind of the biography that's out there about him. I guess he liked the film as a kid. He liked the film by Bergman called Persona. Film I don't know. Do you know it, Abdul?
It's amazing. I mean, it
Persona.
is.
Oh.
Again, it is a fantastic film. It definitely watch it. It's a staggeringly short, 90 minutes long, and it is more, it contains more than a majority of films, like 2 to 3 times its length, right? Again, a terrific film, a film I watched in my first year of film school, definitely not when I was 14. I have a hard time, but like maybe he was grew up in that kind of family, right? But again, like I'm like, this feels like something you put on your boilerplate for your biography and ran with it, right? Like,
Yeah, maybe his parents were artists themselves. I didn't find out exactly what kind of artists they were, but they were very musical. Because Adam, I guess he studied classical guitar when he was young. He attended Trinity College at the University of Toronto, I think for music. I couldn't find out what he had gone there originally for, but he started making films when he was in college at U of T. And so you've already mentioned this, Abdul, that Egoyan was part of what's known as the Toronto New Wave, a group of English Canadian filmmakers who came of age in the 80s and the 90s. So this group included Don McKellar, which we've talked about, Bruce McDonald, Patricia Rosema, and they made art house films. Now, they were helped along by new funding from the Ontario Film Development Corporation, as well as a new festival venue for their movies that was called Perspective Canada. And so this kind of generation of filmmakers enjoyed some opportunities of that sort, but the funding was cut in 1996 after the election of Mike Harris as Ontario Premier. But after 96, I guess Adam Egoyan was already established, I suppose, as many of the names I mentioned.
and the OFDC became Ontario Creates, which has a far more, I would call it, and I love Ontario Creates, just for the record, they finance both my movies, but like it's very much a more sort of commercial oriented mandate in terms of what they fund and what they sort of expect as return, right?
That is a sign of the times of funding for film and television, a more commercial outlook, I think, that starts to dominate in the late 90s. Egoyan's directorial debut came in 1984, so he was 24 years old. The film was called Next of Kin, which is about a dysfunctional family, like a lot of his work tends to be. It won an award at the International Film Festival that's called Mannheim Heidelberg. So he had early success in art house. He wrote and directed several other features in the next 10 years. Like all of them achieved like quite a bit of some acclaim on the festival circuit. Abdul, are there other films of Adam Egoyan's before The Sweet Hereafter that you wanted to mention? We'll talk about Exotica in just a moment.
The only ones I've seen are Exotica, The Sweet Hereafter, Ararat, and then everything after Ararat up until The Captive. So his early films I'm sure are good, but they again they seem very of their era of like, oh, small to medium festival indie art house hits, funded out of this very unique early 90s structure, right? What a glorious time where you could just, make a movie at the age of 24, using OFDC money and just like build a nice little career out of it. I'm sure he's also like clearly very talented, right? But yeah, I've heard
It
people speak
was.
very fondly of that era, I'll put it that way.
Egoyan married actress and activist Arsine Kanjian, and in 1993 they had a son, Arshile. So in 94, Egoyan had a popular breakthrough with the film Exotica. It was about a man grieving the death of his daughter through his relationship with an exotic dancer. Exotica won the International Film Critics Prize at Cannes and the Canadian Screen Award for Best Feature. So after the success of Exotica, Egoyan was hired by Warner Brothers to direct a big budget thriller. It was titled Dead Sleep. Now, Egoyan quit when the producers wouldn't let him cast Susan Sarandon in the lead role, and he went back to independent production. And I guess it was around that time that the option on Russell Banks' novel, The Sweet Hereafter, was about to become available. And that was a project that Egoyan had been planning for some time, so he returned to Toronto to pursue that. Now, I've already mentioned that The Sweet Hereafter, it's adapted from a 1991 novel of the same name by Russell Banks. Now, Egoyan had quite a bit of difficulty acquiring the rights to the novel because they'd already been sold. They already had been purchased. So he had to wait for them to expire before he could get them again. So I guess Margaret Atwood put him in touch with Russell Banks. So Egoyan was able to like gain Banks' personal approval for acquiring the book. So Egoyan said this of the book: "The book has the quality of a fable, and to preserve that, I introduce another fable, Robert Browning's Pied Piper of Hamelin. So it has a quality of a controlling metaphor throughout the film." So the film that is very prominent in the film version of this is this voiceover that returns several times about the Pied Piper, the story of the Pied Piper. That is Egoyan's addition. And I guess we can talk more about the Pied Piper story like a little bit later. So the film is set in British Columbia, this fictional town of Sam Dent. The novel was set in a small town in upstate New York. And the novel, in turn, is based on a real incident that occurred in the community of Alton, Texas in 1989. 21 children drowned after their school bus drove off of the road into a gravel pit that had filled with water. Now, this was a national media event in the United States that attracted carpetbagging lawyers. Ultimately, lawsuits netted survivors and their families about $150 million. Now, one third of this amount went to the various lawyers involved. The cash awards to the townspeople of Alton, you know, how they spent the money, how, you know, sometimes they refused to share it, other people wanted a piece of it, all of this drew criticism and jealousy in the community. And so it was that real incident that inspired the novel. So back to the film here, the outdoor filming of this really nice, like, I mean, the scenery in this film is pretty beautiful. So this was filmed largely in Merritt, British Columbia, and Spences Bridge. So it's the site of the beautiful, stark winter scenery that we get. It was filmed in the fall and early winter of 1996. The studio shooting took place in Toronto. So The Sweet Hereafter was the darling of independent films, of the independent film scene that year. At Cannes, it won the Critics' Prize, the Ecumenical Jury Prize, which is like a Christian filmmakers award, the Grand Jury Prize. It was also nominated for two Academy Awards for Best Direction and Best Adapted Screenplay. Now, Egoyan has made several more films since, although I think The Sweet Hereafter, as we've been saying already, is considered the pinnacle of his filmmaking career. And I already mentioned, it's kind of the last film I remember noticing after Ararat in 2002. That film is about a film crew who are filming a historical drama set in 1915 about the Armenian genocide. So it's like a very meta take on a historical topic. Egoyan's taught filmmaking at U of T and at Ryerson. I already mentioned he likes classical music, so he directs operas. Salome, Così fan tutte, The Ring Cycle. He did this all at the Canadian Opera Company in Toronto. And Egoyan's latest film, from what I could tell, was the 2019 Guest of Honor, which I don't know. And he continues to live in Toronto.
David Thewlis is a fantastic actor. I think
is he in Guest of Honor?
Yeah, he is. I think The Sweet Hereafter is largely considered sort of the end of the Toronto New Wave, right? Like this was sort of a very like a closing bow to an era of filmmaking that sort of ended. A lot of the directors that were associated with the movement petered out. Others are having tremendous comebacks. Clement Virgo, you know, is who never really stopped, but he's finally having his international breakout this year, right, with Brother. So okay. It's like, you know, it's interesting to see where a lot of these guys have gone. And, you know, I believe The Sweet Hereafter is largely considered like both the best and last of these films, you know, before a lot of these people went into teaching or, you know, moved to TV or struggled for a couple of years or, you know, sort of just petered out in one way or another. And I mean, you can see why. I'm just not sure it's right, but you can see why. Very clearly, in terms of how this how the film played out, and also the way it was received, and you know, Roger Ebert was a huge proponent of Adam Egoyan too, right? Like very generous to him throughout his life, sometimes perhaps more so than he deserved, but like yeah, for some reason he became like the darling of Canadian cinema after this, even when. You know, I don't think he ever quite hit the high point of this or Ararat since. a big part of that is also, by the way, Canadian funding.
Ah, interesting.
It changed a lot.
Yeah, and also the you know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, there's always going to be space for the Cronenbergs, the Paulies, the Egoyans, you know, the Bruce McDonalds within the funding envelopes that are in these, like, public-private partnerships, right? Like, that director comes with a movie. It's like, oh, we're going to give you money for it, right? It's just a fact. And stuff like that, which is...
Because they're already established, so yes, yeah.
Yeah, and they're monumental, right? Like, they know that's the kind of director who's going to go places whether or not the movie is good, right? And, I mean, there are good and bads to that, right? But, like, you know, sometimes you get Crimes of the Future, sometimes you get Devil's Knot. Yeah.
Right.
Well, all right, we're going to get into some of the details of this film, what exactly happens and what we think of it. So, you want to... Take us away, Naomi.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, so this film is structured in a very intricate and complex manner, so I don't want to actually go through exactly and, like, describe every shot. I'm going to just kind of go through and give a summary of it in the order in which it's told, which is not chronological at all. And so we start with this shot that kind of recurs throughout the film, which is a family of three sleeping together on a mattress. A man, a woman, and a baby between them. And it's this kind of, like, sunlit, kind of, what's the word, like, idyllic picture.
It has, like, a mythological feel. It seems like it comes out of the distant past, right? Doesn't it, with that lighting?
Yeah.
It feels a lot like an Edward Hopper painting, you know what I mean? Or, like, one of those, like, American pastoral, like, you know, sunbeam through window type of deals. There's a couple I'm thinking of in particular, right? But it feels both simultaneously, like, lonely, warm, and cold at the same time. Like, it's a really it's a really beautiful and, like, inscrutable and kind of compelling image that he keeps returning to. And it is a very, like, engaging way to open the film. It was also used for all the poster material, and you can clearly tell why.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's really
That's
evocative.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And then I think the book by the novel ended up having that as a cover as well, the way novels will, like, a, you know, be published with imagery from the film after there's a film. And yeah, like, it's this image that kind of evokes like this perfect moment that can't last. There's, like, a melancholy to it, right? That there's no way that this kind of perfect family moment could ever continue into the future. At least in retrospect, that's what it seems to evoke, considering that that's what the movie's about. So then in the next scene, in the first scene, I suppose, we see the lawyer, Mitchell Stevens, who's played by Ian Holm, in a car wash. And his daughter Zoe calls him for the first time. This is also something that will recur throughout the movie, kind of in a state. It's kind of, what's the word? Egging him on. And clearly angry with him for kind of mercurial reasons. And he doesn't know where she is. He's worried about her. He's angry with her. He's trying not to seem angry. And then after she hangs up on him, he realizes that he's stuck in the car wash and has to run out through the water. So there's this kind of chaos with him trying to protect himself with a little umbrella from the blasting water and soap of the car wash.
Right.
And then we see Nicole, who is played by Sarah Polley, in a fairground singing to a guy that appears to be gazing at her with admiration and perhaps romantic intent. And she's gazing back at him. And it turns out, you realize after she sung, and I think it's her cover of Courage by The Tragically Hip, which she does a really kind of beautiful job of singing.
I don't know about that.
Well, I really liked it when I saw it in the 90s. And actually, I should say, I saw this when it first came out when I was in my early 20s. And I just loved this movie so much at the time. So, of course, that makes it a bit bittersweet to go back and watch it again, because it couldn't possibly seem as amazing to me now as it did then, just because it's no longer 1998. And
It's
so of its time in certain ways that, of course, then it just, to me at least, seems so fresh and amazing and you know.
Well, as a kid, like,
beautiful.
As a young aspiring artist myself, yeah. I looked at this when this movie came out. I was like, this is the movie that I need to watch and to like. And
oh,
so
really?
That was part of my experience of it.
Oh, okay. Like,
I thought it was pretty good when I was young, but I don't think I totally got it.
Oh my God. I was so captivated by it. Although at the same time, I didn't totally get it. So I'm going to come to that. But then you see Nicole and her, what turns out to be her father, like walking arm in arm, and she calls him daddy. And at least
creepy.
For me, there's this like kind of shocking moment where you realize it's her father. But yeah. As a viewer, which is something really interesting that Egwene does, I know at least for me as a viewer then, I was like, oh, I guess I misunderstood. I thought they were boyfriend and girlfriend, but they're actually father and daughter. And I don't think I actually understood that he had manipulated me into thinking that. I just thought, like, it was just me, which is kind of a neat trick that he does there.
Yeah, so for these opening three shots, we have this kind of beautiful, timeless, almost mythological image of intimate family scene in bed together. And then we have that two scenes where we see that family relation... perverted in some
corrupted.
Way. In the first one, it's like Ian Holm's daughter, who is addicted to drugs, is like, you know, trying to emotionally manipulate him.
Mm-hmm.
And through the shots that are chosen, like close-ups on her mouth, it's like very kind of creepily physical,
mm-hmm.
the way they depict that conversation. And then we see the same thing where there's this very clearly inappropriate a relationship between a father and a daughter
absolutely.
In the next scene.
Yeah. Absolutely. So then we learn that Mitchell is checking into the motel and Sam Dent and the couple who run the motel are one of the pairs of parents who've lost a child in the bus accident. So he's there trying to convince couples around the town to sue or to find someone to sue, essentially, to start a lawsuit and figure out who's responsible for this accident and sue them. And he insists that someone is responsible.
This is the parts of the, like that opening to here is I think where the, my biggest sort of issue with the film begins, which is like Mitchell's characterization. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a very like 90s assessment of drug use and substance use and stuff like that, which is troubling. And you know, there's a very clear like interesting metaphor about his unwillingness to be cleansed, you know, like him running out of the car wash, him like you know, leaning into his like most like lawyerly instincts, but you know, someone like that and Egoyan's, you know, every film he says every film he's ever made or whatever is about the Armenian genocide, right? It's about the diagnosis of evil and accountability, and he said this about this film as well, right?
Very
inspired.
Interesting. So he's looking for, like, the character is looking for someone to blame. He wants to find the root of the evil and punish it.
And that's evil going unpunished. But there, you know, I think my biggest issue sort of thematically with the film is the fact that we try to diagnose Mitchell's, like, reason for introducing chaos into tragedy, right, through this like drug addicted daughter, whereas like, you know, we all know that like lawyers, ambulance chasers, they are basically the devil personified. Like, you know, they come in, their only goal is to try and like make money off of human suffering and stuff like that, and the idea of trying to motivate it in such a what feels like a very obvious way is such, like, he does a great job acting it. He does a great job in terms of his, like, exploration of that character, but it just feels like, you know, this, it really pulls you away from, like, the inter-community drama that the film is best when it's, at its best when it's exploring.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the lawyer is essentially the protagonist of the film, although later Nicole seems to kind of become the protagonist, but we're seeing it all from his point of view, and it begins and ends with him. It's kind of his journey, and yeah, like we are invited to question, you know, to analyze his motivation and to see him, at least to his own mind, as a victim of his drug addicted daughter, where she's violating his boundaries and trying to get money out of him. And as far as we can see, undeserved by him, she's kind of ruining his life and breaking his heart. So
the choice to focus on Mitchell Stevens was that was Adam McGoyan's choice, because the book is told by I think there are five different narratorial perspectives in the book. So it's told by Mitchell Stevens is one of those perspectives, right. But then also Nicole is one of them and others. So I think the book had more of a communal perspective on the issue, and the novel, and the film has chosen to focus in and become more about Mitchell Stevens.
Right. But like Abdullah is saying that, I mean, in, you know, almost all cases, a lawyer who is behaving that way wouldn't have some kind of complicated personal kind of morally upright or at least sympathetic motivation. Yeah. And this, in this case, he absolutely does, where he feels like he needs to understand that he wants to understand why he's lost his daughter. And so he is motivated to try to find a reason for the, you know, the evil that separated these children from their parents.
It also really takes away from like the Grecian, you know, sort of mythic qualities of the film, in terms of like exploring this lawyer's backstory, you know, and in a way that feels like counterintuitive to, again, like the community aspects of the film, which are just so, and also the Pied Piper metaphor, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't need to know why the Pied Piper acts a certain way, right? Like, I don't need to know why these figures exist.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I guess like that's kind of its time too, because at that point in storytelling, I don't feel like it was really very, it wouldn't have been very of its time to have a character that was just pure evil and whose motivations weren't somehow complicated or sympathetic, right?
I'm rereading Blood Meridian right now, right? Which is like very top of mind. And I think about like the judge character in that story a lot, you know, and how like, you know, the more you learn about it, the more, if you were to ever learn about him, it would just completely unravel the book in the worst possible way. I found myself bumping on this lawyer a ton, right? Despite the fact that Ian Holm is terrific. Also, very quickly, I just need to say, when he goes to that first family, rest in peace, Maury Chaykin, one of the greatest Canadian actors of all time. Less Than Kind is the best TV show ever made in Canada. Holy shit.
Yeah.
So nice to see
him. I don't know it.
Yeah, he's hardly in the film. Like, he's the husband of Risa. So they're the couple who run the motel, and she is way more of a central character than he is.
I think that's his only scene. Actually.
Yeah, I think that is his only scene. Is.
Yeah.
But he's lovely. If you've never seen Less Than Kind, it was like, I think, one of Canada's first like HBO shows, right? And it's about a Jewish family in Winnipeg. Oh, okay. And it stopped because Maury Chaykin passed away, you know, but like, he is such a phenomenal character actor who's shown up in so much and just gave like 150%, like, and that character too, right? You get so much out of him for that one scene he's in, and it's just man, I miss Maury Chaykin so much. He was such a great actor in everything he ever showed up in. Like, what a treasure.
Yeah. And in that scene, we get a sense of, he plays like a bitter, unhappy husband. And that he's fighting with his wife at the end of that scene. And he's also talking trash just about all of his neighbors, all the other families who were involved in the bus crash. And so what we get in that scene is a sense of the moral rot or the problems in this community, right? Like you get a sense, we've already had that a little bit with the strange, you know, with Nicole and her weird relationship with her father. We had a hint of that. But like, if I think throughout the film at different times, there's this sense that, there's like, what's the expression from Hamlet? Like,
something's rotten.
Right. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark.
Yeah.
And like, there's a sense of that here. I think that's what.
Yeah, there's like a corruption in this community that's like rotting under the surface. For sure. And then we kind of, Mitchell's asking him to badmouth his neighbors because he's trying to find other parents who could who can join the lawsuit, who are like upstanding citizens who could not, where their characters could not be impugned in any way. And so, there's kind of no one who fits that profile except, perhaps this couple, the Ottos, who are this artsy hippie couple who lost their this white couple who had adopted indigenous son who they lost.
I mean, it's also of its time that that element of the film is sort of not explored, and it's very much played as like they gave an indigenous kid an opportunity and then he died or something like that, which is
like they're saints for having done this. There's no criticism of it, for sure.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah, and that's something that would be very different now if it were to be explored.
You could build a whole movie around their story. That would be very interesting, right? Yeah,
that's so true. So then we have flash forwards 2 years later. Mitchell is on a plane now, and he's on his way to see his daughter, as we gather, and discovers that he's sitting next to an old childhood friend of his daughter, Zoe's. And so she's asking him about Zoe. He doesn't want to talk about it. And he eventually loosens up and starts talking about, you know, how over the years, Zoe has just been in and out of rehab, in and out of programs and counseling, and I think even prison, and that she's been extremely troubled, and he's kind of spent her entire adult life trying and failing to help her, sometimes getting so fed up that he can't bring himself to try to help her, and then being drawn back in, sending her money for things that she ends up not actually using it for, her promising to come and see him and then not showing up, and so on. So he feels very, very worn down and really victimized by the situation. And I mean, I guess I kind of have a question about whether he feels like sympathy or empathy for his daughter. He seems to feel very much under attack by her and also beholden to her. And sorry, Abdul, I'll just say one more thing. He hates her.
Yeah, he does. He seems to hate her.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was saying it does come across that way, that he hates her.
Yeah. I mean, he does feel that she's ruined his life and that he is just, like a hapless victim of her kind of corrupted personality.
Behavior, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, I think the film is supposed to, we're supposed to sympathize with him.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like we're supposed to wonder, you know, did he do something to her to make her this way? Or does he deserve her treatment of him to any extent? Or even, you know, should we feel just as bad for her as we feel for him? Like, she's the one suffering from.
Right. It's a very unsympathetic portrayal of the daughter, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. I will say that scene where he meets the old friend on the airplane is, like, it's such, it is one of the best scenes in the movie because it tells you so much so well in like a really elegant way. Like, it is, and again, like, you know, not to harp on Adam McGoin's later filmography, but like, you know, a scene like that is just so complex and, you know, so dense and does so much. And just the way it's acted, the way it's shot, the actions the characters take, the way they're speaking is so engaging and gives you so much in so little time, right? It's just like, it's such a perfectly put together moment in the movie that's just like, it's astounding, right? Like, I went back and I rewound the film and watched that scene twice when I was watching this last night.
It is great dialogue, and the way that, you know, one of the character, that Zoe's friend, is trying to get information out of the father, Mitchell, and he just won't give it, and there's this kind of push and pull in that dialogue that happens with very few words and happens very quickly.
Well, and of course, when you're writing, you're always trying to find a way to get exposition in at times, right? And that's just such a great opportunity for exposition to naturally arise.
Right, where she's asking him for the backstory of Zoe, but he's not just willingly telling it either.
That's right, so we get character from him. It's great. It is a wonderful scene. Yeah.
You read the exposition and the subtext, which is some of the hardest things to do as a writer, especially in screenplays, right? Where it's like, how much is too much?
Right.
Sort of question you're always asking. And he sort of nails this perfect like everything about it works. It just, it goes in such a way that it feels very effortless when it's, you know, that's something that, I know. It's a perfect scene in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have all of these kind of scenes that are and the that are playing out and that are interwoven with each other in this back and forth. So we have the plane scene. We also have the scene of the bus on the day of the accident driving through the town and picking up all the children. And we have aerial shots of the bus driving through this beautiful mountain pass, stopping at all the different houses, picking up the different kids. We have, and we also have what will be a scene that we kind of see over and over, which is Nicole showing up at Billy's. So Billy is another parent, a single parent who's lost his wife some years ago and has twins who are lost in the bus accident. So we see Nicole showing up at his house to to babysit the twins. And during that babysitting scene, she reads to them, or babysitting sequence, I should say, she reads to them the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And then that becomes the voiceover that we hear over some of the other scenes. Then meanwhile, Billy is following the bus in his truck, which we learn that he did every day, waving to his kids who are in the back. And we also learn that Billy is having an affair with Risa, the owner of the motel, and that he goes to the motel at prearranged times to have sex with her. And so these are the series of events that we're seeing all kind of interplay together. And there's this tension built in because we know the bus is going to crash, but we're forced to wait to see it. And then, of course, there's also Mitchell interviewing different characters about what happened, including the bus driver, Dolores. So
what do you think about Dolores as a character? She seems like she's supposed to be like the perfect bus driver. She loves the kids. She has pictures of them on her wall. And obviously, she did nothing wrong. She was the best bus driver ever. So careful in her job, right? What do you think about that character?
Her trauma is expressed in a really interesting way. You know, like she comes off as one note at first, and like there's points in the film where if I remember correctly, like she's referring to the kids in the present tense.
Yes.
Right? And then she comes back and she, you know, there's a really great button on the scene where she's talking about Bear, like the indigenous child, right? And where she acknowledges he's gone, and that's a really like crucial moment. She's like maybe the most inscrutable character in the film because she is the simplest, right? Like, and like, you know, it's a very straightforward, like I am this person, I am struggling to overcome this, but her personality from the flashbacks to the present doesn't seem to have like shifted in any huge way. Like it's very easy to play her as simple, but you know, there's a lot there. I attribute a lot of that to the actor whose name I cannot remember, but she does a phenomenal job with what could have been like a very, very flat sort of performance.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, she's portrayed as this like very sweet, kind of not stupid but simple person who just loves the kids, loves her job as a bus driver, and then when this happens to her, this accident, she just, it's almost like she's too sweet and sort of simple to process it at first, and she's just able to continue because she's living in a kind of denial where she still thinks of the children in the present tense, and she doesn't also seem to have a complicated, when she does acknowledge the accident, like she's tearful and she's obviously grieving over it, but she doesn't seem to feel any guilt or any kind of like doubt that it was not her fault, right? I mean, she knows that this is something terrible that happened to her, not something that she is in any way responsible for. I feel like a lot of characters or a lot of people would feel some kind of like horrific guilt about that, but she doesn't seem
That would and that would disrupt the argument the film's making, that actually nobody is responsible for this bus accident, at least not directly and not materially. And so if she
certainly not her.
And so if she had any self-doubt, that would actually muddy the waters on that point.
It would be too complicated.
Film actually really needs us to know for sure that nobody is to blame for
especially
this.
Especially not her.
So yeah, and then one more thing too about like the up until the bus accident happens, there's so much, because we know the film is about a bus accident, we're waiting for it, right? So the tension is really strong. It's like really dramatically well done, where you're just like waiting to see it happen. Like, when is this going to happen? We know it's going to happen. And so in all these scenes up until, I guess, the middle of the movie, more or less when the accident does happen, are extremely tense. You're like, what's going to happen next? Also, because of the way the film jumps around in time, it could literally go anywhere next. Mm-hmm. We know it's not following chronological order. So any scene could be the scene where it happens, right?
Right. That's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, arguably, it could be seen as a kind of cheap way to create tension when you're like, and I feel like you could only hold out for so long before you let the audience see it happen, right? Before, as a viewer, you're just like, this is ridiculous. I'm not, like, I'm no longer caught up in this. I'm just annoyed. But what do you think, Abdul?
I think the film does, I mean, to your point, like, you know, I think we're also waiting to see the aha moment of like, whose fault this is, right? Like, whose fault is it really, right? Like, when we see the bus accident, we realize, oh no, it's everyone's right. It is no one's fault. Like, there's no hidden, there's no hidden turn that like something X, Y, or Z happened that caused this, right? And so, you know, when the film is like roughly split into two halves, you know, split up by the bus accident, it's like, you know, even as an audience, you're now building into a second point of tension where you're like, well, no one was to blame.
Right.
It was no one's fault. And when we were expecting some sort of easy turn that, oh, something was missed or, you know, we could blame a very specific person. It's like, no, we can't. Like, we have to grapple with that.
Yes. But right before we see the actual accident happen, we see, Sam, Nicole's father, pick her up from babysitting the kids and take her to the barn where they proceed to have a incestuous romantic encounter. I mean, and while we see this happening, we hear the voiceover of the Pied Piper story, arguably implying that this kind of level of corruption is directly linked to what happened to the children, why the town lost all of its children. When I first saw this film in my early 20s, I did not notice that scene. Like, somehow after I saw that movie, I had no idea that there was incest in it, and other people told me there was. And then when I watched it again, I was like, oh yeah, I mean, how could I have missed that? Somehow my brain just like wouldn't accept what was happening. And I read an interview with Adam McGuigan where he talks about like a lot of viewers not having realized that there was an incestuous scene between the father and daughter, and that in fact that relationship was what was driving a lot of what happened afterwards. And it's like almost as though viewers just couldn't accept what they were seeing. So what do you think about that, all of that, Abdul?
I think like, cause I had also totally forgotten about the scene until I watched it yesterday. But I think because it goes straight from that to the bus crash, your memory just sort of elides the incest scene, right? Because you get this like catharsis of the bus crash, you know, happening and stuff like that. But this is a sequence I have that challenges me a little bit on the movie. Again, it's a well-crafted movie. It's very dense. It's like very elegantly put together, right? But it's like, you know, my brain jumped to like the very obvious where it's like, is the bus crash like an outcome of the moral rot in this small town?
Right.
Like, is it a moral argument you're making that, you know, the unexplained, it can't be explained physically, but on an emotional level, you understand how and why this bus crash happened as
right. And that seems to undercut what like the point, which seems to be at first that there is no one to blame and there is no reason for it happening. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of my and I, again, it goes with a lot of like Egoyan's filmmaking where it is trying to impose moral order on chaos, right? Which goes back to like this idea of like, oh, Mitchell and his frustration with his daughter, or just like, you know, his very understandable emotional and historical trauma at the Armenian genocide, right? And stuff like that, but it I disagree with the thesis. Yeah, and like thematically, I disagree with that as an effective or compelling argument.
Right. And it's weird because at first you're totally, at least I am totally on board with the kind of like, the point is things sometimes happen for no reason. Terrible things happen for no reason. And
well, they happen for reasons that nobody in particular is responsible for.
Right. Like there's a reason like that there was ice on the road or whatever.
The weather. It was an act of God.
Right. But I mean, that is,
I think the movie suggests. But anyway, go ahead.
It happened. It was without any meaning. Okay. Like, I guess that's what I mean. There wasn't a meaningful reason. And then it seems to kind of do this about face where it's like, actually there is a reason, a moral reason. Like in Hamlet, right? Like that's kind of the state of things is corrupt.
But in Hamlet, at least there's a direct. In Hamlet, at least there's a direct connection. It's like things are corrupt, but that led to, you know, the brother murdering the brother for power. Like that's like actually direct.
Like it's not a magical kind of connection.
This movie.
Except that there's a ghost.
This movie ambiguously, but it's clearly there, is hinting that these people are being punished for the moral rot in their community.
Yeah.
That the transgression against their children is being like visited upon them in retribution this way, that they're going to have their children taken away from them. Like it does suggest that. It's a very like religious point of view. Like the way that when I don't know, like what is a faith-based response to an accident, and you say, well, why did this happen? We didn't deserve this. This isn't right. You kind of go to a cosmic point of view and say, well, from God's perspective, some good will come of this. This was what had to happen. And I think that's what the movie is ultimately suggesting too, because of the accident, Nicole is going to get revenge on her father.
Yeah.
And she's enabled to become a better person herself for some justice to be restored in that parent-daughter relationship because of the accident. So there is this, I think, very problematic moral, I think religious sort of version of morality in this movie. Yeah. I think.
It does seem to be there.
I think like there's also an interesting thing with watching this film after the Saskatchewan bus crash. Right. Where regardless of who went to jail or who was deported from it, like ultimately, you know, it was a systemic failure, right? Like it was a failure of very tangible physical things that are beyond our control, namely the total lack of signage at this place, right? The lack of adequate features. Like there is a way to assign blame in this, in as much as, you know, yeah, it's completely unforeseeable accident, but like at the end of the day, the lawsuit is correct, right? Like there are the roads, there are the buses, there are the fact that, like, you know, you have not properly equipped these spaces to functionally save or work in such a way that they prevent people from dying, right? Instead, it chooses this moral outcome, and like even the end of the film feels like, oh, this town does not deserve the windfall it may get, right? Like morally,
that's right.
Yeah,
it does not deserve to see remuneration for this. It's like it deserves to suffer, which is such a like
forever.
Strange outcome of the film's like themes.
But yeah, money doesn't matter. What matters is Nicole's coming into her own, about taking the power back in her relationship with her father, all as a result of this bus accident. And it's like really interesting that this fictionalization, this like adaptation of a fictionalization of a real event, has actually erased all of those, has really changed the story dramatically, because the real story in the bus accident in Alton, Texas, indeed involved many people who did things wrong and who were clearly to blame, such as a truck driver who was driving a Dr. Pepper truck who ran a stop sign. The fact that there was also no guardrails along the road, so that's a fault of poor urban planning. The fact that these gravel pits had been allowed to just sit there and fill with water, which is again like, which is again, you know, it's a failure of road safety and urban planning, etc. So there is like a lot of people were to blame for the actual accident that this story is based on. And I think that the fictionalization of it is so interesting. He's decided to remove all of that.
Well, he wants it to be a fable, like he said.
A fable,
to make it a fable. Like, the message of the fable is, well, I mean, kind of, I guess it shouldn't be too clear, but it's a little bit, it's muddled for sure. Interestingly, at the next scene after the crash, we see Mitchell again telling the story on the plane about this momentous moment when Zoe, as a young girl, as basically a baby, was bitten by a spider and almost died. So we see the scene from the beginning again with the family of three in bed, and we realize it's Mitchell, his ex-wife, and Zoe as a toddler. And in the story that Mitchell tells Zoe's friend on the plane, Zoe is bitten by a black widow spider and almost dies. Mitchell has to, they're out in some rural place in a cottage, and they have to get to a hospital. And on the drive, Mitchell has to be prepared to give her an emergency tracheotomy by cutting into her neck, her throat, with a knife. So he's sitting there holding her, keeping her calm, comforting her, and is meanwhile prepared to stab her in the throat to stop her, to enable her breathing if her throat totally closes up. Mm-hmm. And so he's describing this, you know, what he was willing to do as a father in this moment, in this life or death moment. And meanwhile, you know, it's back at this time when Zoe was innocent and had not done anything yet to corrupt his love for her. And so his love for her is like pure, and she's pure. She's innocent, and she's looking up at him with these big trusting eyes. And that's kind of contrasted with, you know, how we've seen her now always trying to get something out of him in this, in the context of the movie, the way that it's framed, this like greedy and selfish way, mm-hmm. This corrupted way. So, and that scene, of course, like, is central to the themes of the film we're given to understand, which is this, you know, how the relationship between parents and children, fathers and daughters, especially in this film, is very central, starts out in this kind of, with this pure, innocent kind of potential, and then is, I think, we're kind of led to think, inevitably corrupted
by life entering. Yeah, we've returned to that mythical moment, that image that's so haunting and beautiful and very, so clearly apart from the timeline of the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. We've returned to it, and we realized how it's actually connected to Mitchell Stevens. It's right. Actually his flashback. Yes. So it's connecting it to history, to time,
right?
As we see it in the movie. And we're on, yeah, I guess the suggestion is, I don't know, like, it is a very beautiful scene we see, and it's haunting. You see him ready with his knife to do this damage to his child in, you know, for the sake of the mm-hmm. child. I don't know. What do you think about Abdul?
Abdul hates it.
I mean, I don't hate it. I think there is something interesting there, right? It's like, you know, it's a very explicit metaphor around like how parents will always like mess their kids up no matter how hard they try not to. Right.
Right.
But, you know, I think, and it goes back to like more like Ian Holm's performance, where I think there's an interesting suggestion that he wishes in a way he hadn't saved her life.
Mm,
right.
I like never thought of that. Yeah.
There's an undercurrent there where when he speaks about it, he's speaking about it with an element of like he is being punished for this act, or would it have been better if he just hadn't, because of the way that her life is now. You know,
oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something he has to grapple with.
Yeah, so I'm just going to finish or continue to summarize the plot here, because we're jumping ahead and talking about other things as well. But we do learn that Nicole is now in a wheelchair. She goes home from the hospital, and her father's like constructed this new fancy bedroom for her that's like supposed to make her feel like a princess. And that, I suppose, is implied he's created for her out of like a sense of horrific guilt. And then meanwhile, we learn that Billy becomes the voice of reason, the father Billy of the twins, who is opposed to the lawsuit. So he's going around trying to convince the other parents. He's confronting Mitchell and confronting the other parents that are involved in the lawsuit, and trying to talk them out of it. He is the one who keeps saying this did not happen for a reason. It's no one's fault, that we have to move on. And he sees the lawyer as a pure ambulance chaser. And then we see Zoe call Mitchell and tell him that she's HIV positive, which is the reason that he's on the plane, that he's told her that he's going to go and take care of her, or that he will do in 2 years from now. So, I mean, we also suddenly, when we see Nicole go home from the hospital and have her new bedroom, she has this little sister that we've never met before. And, you know, like, Nicole has this protective vibe towards her sister, and she has this kind of saintly personality where she's always being motherly towards other kids in the town. She's clearly kind of an overachiever. She's, like, very pretty. Her character, in a way, reminded me of Laura Palmer in Twin Peaks, where she's this, like, abused and corrupted teenager who actually also turns out to have been sexually abused by her father. And although her father is possessed by a demon, so it's a little bit different. But but she's also this saintly... Yeah, it's very 90s. It's very 90s. So she's like this... Laura Palmer is like the beautiful prom queen who everyone loves. And like she's sort of... Yeah, everyone in town is in love with her. And she has this kind of saintly disposition.
I mean, I think it sort of is. Yeah, like I think it's that... It is that like very 90s thing of like you're trying to figure out how to put women in stories and like Western filmmaking in a way that's like, you know, somewhat subversive relative to like the way it was largely done like the 80s. And it's like, no, the solution is to have this like perfect person, but let's make their home life even darker. It's not that their dad won't let them it's not that their dad won't let them dance, you know what I mean? It's that he's like a horrible sexually abusive guy, and it's like it's and eventually they stand up to him, and it's like the two things are just not commensurate with each other, like the crime versus the outcome, which I would describe this film as sort of really leaning into that. I will say the combinative reveals of like the daughter, which is far more interesting with the HIV plot, and again the fact that these two things work in parallel felt really... It goes back to the film's like moral engine, right? It's like, oh, she is Mitchell's daughter is suffering for her transgressions now in this like way that we and again in the 90s understand is like, you know, HIV is still a moral... Is there a moral response to degeneracy, right? Which I really fucking hated that, and it layered like one level of tragedy on top of the film in a way that it had a really delicate balance of like how much tragedy is too much, and that just tilted it like straight into the bad kind of melodrama.
I know what you mean.
It felt like an out. It felt like an out, and it felt really bothersome. And again, like we're watching this with the context of like years of critical analysis of these sorts of stories, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
If she had anything, it would have felt the same way. It would have felt like it's like this is some sort of God's punishment, right?
I suppose.
But, like, but the HIV in particular, right, is such like an active... Yeah. You have such an active attachment to it in terms of like the things that cause HIV, and it's like...
Right.
That was where I really lost the movie at that moment, was like, I hate this so much.
Right.
Where she's in the phone booth and he's on his like cell phone, his hilarious cell phone, right?
And it's true, that like, character is completely thrown under the bus.
Completely.
Like,
Oh, it's such a terrible depiction of a person having addiction issues. Yeah. They're totally dehumanized.
Yeah.
They really are.
Yeah, and she is, like, victimizing her father for no reason. Like, he just 100% doesn't deserve it, I guess. I mean, maybe as a viewer, I kind of, like, superimpose some kind of other interpretation on that, you know, maybe he had done something terrible to her, or maybe we were supposed to sympathize with her, or maybe the way he was treating her was, like, too unsympathetic. But I think you're right that like that's not really the way
the film turns her into a curse, essentially. Instead of seeing drug addiction as something with material causes,
like a curse that she carries,
this is like she's a cursed entity in his life now, like a burden for him.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's just
So then, okay, the story goes on. Billy comes over and argues with Nicole's parents, trying to talk them out of the lawsuit, and Nicole overhears their conversation and is distraught by it, because I think we're led to interpret her point of view as hearing her father greedily wanting this money from the lawsuit, and caring more about the money, kind of seeing her as instrumental to becoming wealthier. So then we go to like the kind of climax of the movie, the deposition, where Nicole recounts her version of events. And until now, we know that she can't remember the accident or anything leading up to it. But all of a sudden, she claims that she can remember it. And she says she remembers that Dolores was driving too fast, says that she actually could see the speedometer and knows that the bus was going way too fast over the speed limit, and that the accident, therefore, was 100% Dolores's fault. She destroys the lawsuit by giving this deposition where mm-hmm. everyone knows she's lying. And then, just to finish up here, we have the last scene of the movie where Mitchell ends his plane ride 2 years later, and he sees Dolores at the airport. She is now driving a minibus at the airport, and they make eye contact. And then you hear this voiceover from Sarah Polley, where she talks about how that Mitchell, the thing that he doesn't understand is that she says, we're all citizens of a different town now, a town of people living in the sweet hereafter. Then we see her at the fairgrounds again, looking up at the Ferris wheel, melancholically, and then we're back. And then it ends with her back in the babysitting scene that occurred right before we saw her sexually abused by her father. She puts the children to bed. She finishes reading the Pied Piper, and then she walks out of the room, and she kind of walks into this beam of light coming in the window, and it ends with her standing in this brightly lit hallway.
So that final scene, the deposition scene, it's really good dramatically. Yes. Because we don't know what's going to happen. We really don't. And in her telling this lie about what happened on the bus, the cuts kind of to her father to see his reaction along the way. You kind of wonder, you know, she's going to say something or do something, and you're not sure what it's going to be. You wonder, is she going to out her father right now and just tell everybody what happened? Or the more subtle, I guess, and more psychologically complex event is what she does, which is like sabotage him, mm-hmm. sabotage his lawsuit.
Yeah.
And it is complicated because he wanted the money. The film makes you understand through other people's reactions as well that he's being greedy. They don't really need this money. He's just being greedy, and it's going to have a deleterious effect on the community if everyone gets money and this lawsuit draws out. And so, but it is probably, so the lawsuit is ruined, and in that act, Nicole is empowered. She gets revenge, and you see in the tail end of that scene, her dynamic with her father is very different. Now she's telling him to do things.
Yeah.
And he has to. I mean, she basically can blackmail him at any moment now, and so she understands that and has achieved this kind of power over him. Where that's supposed to be a good thing, and it is. You see it as a good thing, but you also, it is rather complicated because this is a person who's not going to, you know, how is she going to, when you think about it materially, what it means for someone who's going to be disabled her entire life, she could have really used that money.
Yeah.
But again, the film is like, well, no, this kind of more vague ethical achievement is worth much more than the money.
Right. Like the money is purely symbolic.
Yeah.
In the plot. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
This idea that the town doesn't deserve any recompense for what happened to them. Any sort of forward moving closure for anyone, you know, it's like they deserve to live in this idea of limbo, right? Like the titular sweet hereafter. Right. And that is where they must be, right? Except for the sacrificial lamb of the movie, who is the bus driver, right? She is the only person who deserves to move on. She is the only person who deserves closure because she is the only person who has no obvious, you know, transgression, right? Because, like, Billy has infidelity, like, you know, obviously yeah. Sarah Polley and her father, all the people you meet are, like, damaged. They're all very complex and difficult people struggling with their own actions. But the bus driver is just a nice woman taking care of her dad or whatever, right? And like, you know,
her husband. I think it's her husband.
It's her husband.
Sorry, husband. Yeah. She's perfect.
Yeah, he suffered a stroke, yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah, she is perfect. She is.
And she deserves, what do you, and she's the only person who deserves an out.
That's right.
What do you make of the sweet hereafter? I mean, this is a phrase to describe heaven, right? What does it mean that we've used that to describe the town now.
I find that last line so weird and unsatisfying and bizarre. Like,
it doesn't match.
No, it doesn't.
I think it comes from the novel.
It's meant to be ironic, right? Like, mm-hmm. like what okay. she's really describing. What she's really describing is either a version of hell or limbo. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's, you know, just calling it sweet, you know, like, obviously we understand it's not sweet.
Yes.
Right? And it's stuff like that. So I think it's meant to be, and it sort of ties back into the fact that she's taken back her power, right? Like, she articulates a sort of contempt that, you know, through that line that, you know, upends the words she's saying or whatever. But yeah, like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it also just pulls you into, to me, it just felt like, okay, so now we're in this realm of the kind of mythic or like magical where, you know, in a realistic story, probably most of these people would move away from this town. And certainly like Nicole would move away as soon as possible and like never see her parents again, probably, you know. And live the rest of her life. And the other parents, why would they stay in this small mm-hmm. town where this awful thing had happened to them? But it's kind of implied that they're stuck here forever. And kind of like the children trapped in the mountain, you know, in the Pied Piper. There's really no outside of this town for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm curious. I don't know what happened with Humboldt, if people stayed in the town or moved away. You know, I'm curious how much that lives in reality. Again, like the retrospective on the, I know our media ecosystem is different and stuff like that, but the retrospective with the hindsight of Humboldt being so relatively fresh in our cultural memory, and the kind of, you know, and the fact that the outcome of that was rage, right? It was mm-hmm. not the mm-hmm. kind of static, you know, frustration,
melancholy. Looking for someone.
Yeah, it was pure unbridled anger. It was hate, right? And it's interesting to play the real life. I don't know about the Texas one. It was probably the same because they got that huge lawsuit, right? But like, you know, it's interesting to play that against something like this where it is like melancholy, where there is complexity, where there's no moral, but like, you know, I also think asking people to look morally inwards during this kind of shared grief is, you know, it's just a logical bump you have to accept in order to watch the movie. So, you know, I don't want to harp on it, but yeah. I was surprised that we didn't, that, you know, those sorts of more active outward elements of rage just never played, because that is the extra potent layer of emotion that, you know, that the film is denying us constantly.
Yeah, and actually Ian Holm, the lawyer, Mitchell Stevens, he's trying to invoke that. He's trying to stoke that feeling in the townspeople.
He's telling them they're angry, you're asking.
And in a couple of scenes, he performs that anger pretty vividly. But we understand that's wrong. Like, that's his problem. Like, it's actually, the film leads us to believe that's the wrong response.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But I think the film, I mean, and this is very 90s again, and I think it's part of what really made me love it personally the first time, is that it's like you're under like a big wool blanket of melancholia while you're watching it, you know? Like, there's just this like sadness that you kind of wallow in. I think that's something that, like, as a culture, we really somehow enjoyed in the 90s.
In the 90s, we thought that was...
profound.
That was profound.
Yeah.
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 Being sad meant that it was clearly correct.
Yeah, and sad and beautiful. Like, I mean, the imagery of this mountain town is so beautiful that it made me want to go and live in the BC interior, you know? Like, I was completely taken with, like, just so taken with that landscape and the shots of the mountains and mm-hmm. the snowy, you know, mountain pass. It's like otherworldly in its beauty.
Yeah
And the pervasive sense of like loneliness that accompanies it, right?
Just
the idea that all these people have at the end of all things is each other, right? It goes back to the title, and, you know, Sarah Polley's last line is like, they're stuck in limbo mm-hmm. together, right? That's why mm-hmm. the money would be a bad thing. You know, it would create friction, because I think the implication is that they should move away maybe, but like, they never can, right? That's just a conceit in the film.
I don't, any other closing thoughts on The Sweet Hereafter, Abdul?
I mean, I think it is, it does have a sort of tone and like I said, like elegance. It is like a very dense and engaging movie. It's multifaceted. It's very complex and like layered. I think there is like good cinema, and it's a good movie, right? Don't get me wrong. Like there is so much to it. And especially compared to, like, again, Egoyan's later work, it's, you know, this is definitely, like, a very high point. At the same time, I'm not sure how much of the film I, like, emotionally agree with. And when it does take a misstep, it, like, really takes a fucking misstep. Right? Like, I go back to the HIV thing, you know, and stuff like that. And sort of its own, like, moral argument, its moral engine is just so off kilter that it is hard for me to love the movie despite how well written and how well put together it is.
What are your final thoughts on The Sweet Hereafter, Naomi?
I mean, like so many other things we've talked about on this podcast, revisiting cultural artifacts from the 90s, that was when I was in my teens and like late teens, early 20s, and of course, the way that I understood things then has shifted so much. Mm-hmm. And in this case, sometimes, you know, I've said, oh, I didn't understand or appreciate that then, and now I do. And this is kind of the opposite, where I idealized it then. I thought it was perfect. And now, of course, I can see its flaws. And some of that is just not aging well in some of those ways, like where, like, for instance, we've, like, learned to think differently about certain things, or I have, like... Yeah. But also, I think there's just a lot there that I didn't notice the first time, which is the moralizing and the problematic, for sure. Like, what's the word? Just completely villainizing of that daughter character who is depicted as, you know, just a blight on her father's life, as Abdul has said. And also, yeah, I mean, the kind of Twin Peaks-esque infatuation with like that melancholia slash darkness slash, you know, beautiful mountain town. It obviously doesn't seem as appealing anymore. So yeah, I mean, obviously I don't purely love it as much as I did, but I still think it's a beautiful movie, and I still understand why I loved it so much before. It's not ruined.
I'm very happy to have watched it again.
Yes.
I'm very happy to have done that. And Abdul, thanks so much for talking about The Sweet Hereafter with us today.
No worries.
Your perspective as a filmmaker has been very helpful.
So good.
Do you want to take us, do you want to like tell us about any of your ongoing or upcoming projects, Abdul, AKA a plug?
Season 3 of CTV's medical drama Transplant is currently airing right now. I did write on that season, a story editor for most of the season, and then I also co-wrote episode 305, which I believe airs next week or the week after. Okay. I really enjoyed that experience. I have a
excellent.
I have a series I was a producer and executive story editor on, premiering tentatively January 1st on Super Channel and Crave, called Streams Flow from a River. I'm very excited for people to see. And my second feature film I wrote is in just entered post-production after a very tumultuous COVID and TIFF derailed shooting schedule.
I bet.
It's called Queen Tut. It's a film in the vein of stuff like Pride or Billy Elliot, about an immigrant drag queen fighting gentrification in Toronto's East End. So yeah, like, you know, not The Sweet Hereafter. Not that that's a bad thing.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Lots of stuff going on, and yeah. We'll have you back to maybe discuss, I don't know, another Adam McGoyan film. Just kidding. We could talk about anything else too, but it was really great having you.
If you ever do Don McKellar's Last Night, please.
We will.
Absolutely. That is, and we have that on our schedule. So we'll definitely give you a call. And Naomi, anything else we should say to the audience out there?
just thank you, as always, for listening / watching, and send us money.
Okay, take care, everybody.
Thank you. I had a great time.